Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the delight today of welcoming two guests to my podcast to talk about some very interesting and relevant developments in the field. I have the pleasure of welcoming back to the podcast Dr. Ute Huskin, who is at the South Asian Institute at the Department of Cultural and Religious History of South Asia at Heidelberg. And also, I welcome Nicole Merkel-Hilf to the podcast, who is at the Center for Asian and Transcultural Studies at Heidelberg. Welcome to the podcast, both of you.
Hello, Raj.
Hello, yes. And thank you for the invitation.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Now, listeners will know that very recently we had a podcast with Ina Ilkama on the play of the feminine. And if you listen to it carefully, you'll notice that we made mention of the location that is published as part of the series called Ethno-Indology, the Heidelberg Studies in South Asian Rituals, and also their other subsections of the series. We're here to put the series on your radar, and particularly where the series has moved to. So, Ute, do you want to tell us a bit more about the series and your involvement in it?
Yes, absolutely. I'm actually a newcomer as a co-editor of this series, Ethno-Indology, Heidelberg Studies in South Asian Rituals. The series exists since, I think, 2005. At least the first volume appeared in 2005. And until recently, it has been edited by Axel Michaels alone. Axel Michaels is a well-known Indologist and also my predecessor here at the Chair of Culture and Religious History of South Asia. And we now, since the beginning of this year, we are co-editors of this series, and now we're doing it together. There are the series had been published before by Harasowitz in Wiesbaden, and there's a number of important changes that have been taking place since the beginning of the year. But maybe I should first talk a little bit about the content of the series, or let's say the books that we would like to publish and that kind of books that have been published. So it's, I mean, Ethno-Indology, I'm very well aware of that for English native speaker sounds a bit unusual. What it says is that it is for publication that engage with both texts and practices and combine text and practice in the analysis. So what we especially welcome monographs, but also thematic edited volumes that examine the relationship between lived cultures and textual traditions. So here, at least in Germany, Ethno-Indology has become quite established subfield of both Christology and Anthropology of South Asia.
Yeah. Do you want to say a little word about, well, I think it's fantastic that these two sort of, these realms are being brought together, but would you say that is a relatively recent trend overall? Would you say that's fairly established in Indology overall?
Well, actually, it is, coming from the, I'm educated, I'm trained as classical Indologist. So my basic training is in philology. So for philologists, this is something relatively new, even though it is absolutely true. Many of our predecessors also included their knowledge of lived traditions in their analysis. But what is different now is that it's an explicit program and an agenda behind this. Also, that's a major difference. And it is, of course, different from anthropology in the sense that it there's always an inclusion of textual analysis, and not only of contemporary texts in contemporary languages, but also of texts in Sanskrit or Middle Indic languages, for example.
Yeah, I think important connections are being made by virtue of this marriage of philology and of religion, and particularly, you know, the surprising ways in which we see both continuities and innovations from, you know, ancient texts and what's happening on the ground today. And so it's fascinating. So if there are scholars listening who, there might be grad students and many of our colleagues listen who are intrigued by this, are there particular suggestions or requirements or topics, or what would you say to people who might be interested in publishing in this series?
Well, as this series basically has its roots in a special research program that was established at Heidelberg University in the beginning of the 2000s, which was called Ritual Dynamics, many of the volumes that have been published in this series so far are dealing in one way or another with rituals. And rituals, of course, lend themselves very much towards this ethno-Indology approach, because very often there is the explicit claim by the practitioners that the rituals or their practice are based on a certain text. At the same time, the practices are also there to be observed. And since it is, rituals are performances, and so what a number of the volumes also include are audiovisual material, which not only illustrate what is being said, but which actually add to the analysis, I would say. And while this audiovisual material has been published as DVDs in the beginning of the 2000s and was basically in the back of the book, now since we are moved to Heidelberg Asian studies publishing, this audiovisual material is provided on a website in a so-called enriched, Frau Merkel, you have to tell me what it is called.
We call it enhanced ebooks.
Yes, that's what I meant.
That sounds like a perfect segue for Nicole to tell us a bit about the platform and the publishing process, perhaps. And in passing, I want to say, this sounds like very rich material for teaching, really and truly, because of the multimedia dimensions, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a number of issues on life cycle rituals, especially Axel Michaels and Niels Gutschow have published three volumes. The first one is called Handling Death. They all deal with rituals in Nepal, handling death. So it's about death and ancestor rituals. Then there's another volume that is about initiations, and the third volume about weddings. And all these volumes, also my own volume on a prenatal life cycle ritual, are accompanied by audiovisual material which goes along with the texts and which are connected to the texts. And by the way, very important to say, with a move from Harasowitz to HASP, to the new publisher, now all the volumes are available in open access, so they can be downloaded for free. And of course, the audiovisual material can be watched online.
Fantastic. Nicole, would you want to say a little bit about the move and the new setting of the series?
Yes, I can tell you a bit about HASP, as we abbreviate Heidelberg Asian Studies Publishing. And it was founded in 2016 and is part of a project funded by the German Research Foundation. First, we named it Cross Asia E-Publishing, which was due to a collaboration we had with the State University in Berlin. And in 2022, we renamed this to Heidelberg Asian Studies Publishing. And our mission or aim is to make research available in open access worldwide so that everyone can participate in the research results, can read and download the books for free. And when Ute Hüsken approached us and said they want to move their series to HASP, I was really excited because it's a very prestigious series and I was happy to have it in our portfolio. And we started publishing in green open access all the books that have been printed before by Harasowitz. And we converted the video files that were on the DVD and to MP4 files and added them to our platform. So users can download the books and they can watch the video files online. And with new publications, we can produce HTML versions of the book and then integrate the audio and video files into the HTML version. So readers can watch videos while they have also the book on the screen. And I think that's a great asset. And I'm not sure if there are many publishers out there who can offer this service already.
I can say perhaps I'm uniquely positioned, having done hundreds of podcasts. There are not many publishers at all, if any. Very few, certainly within the ambit of South Asian studies, Indian religions, Indology, broadly speaking. And so this is no small boon. This is huge and it's important. And really, to my mind, you are the face of the future in some sense of both the expectations of current generations, also the needs of current researchers and really, you know, who knows in how many decades from now. I think perhaps if all goes well, you'll be more the rule than the exception in coming years. But tell us a bit about how is it that you're able to do that? Maybe a little bit about the model in terms of if there was a scholar who was interested in publishing in this series and, you know, submitting their abstract, their proposal and whatnot. Is there funding that one can apply for? Does the scholar or the institution fund the open access project? How would that work for a scholar?
Scholars interested in publishing with HASP, they send us a book proposal, which can be downloaded from our website. And then the proposal goes to our advisory board. They decide if we accept it. And then the next step would be that we talk, of course, to the with the author to get some more details and about the expectation and wishes. And then we can clarify details such as peer review, open peer review, or double-blind peer review, what kind of peer review procedure is best for the author and the book. And of course, we also have to discuss things like layouting and typesetting of the book and copy editing. The layout and typesetting is a service which we can offer, but we do not do this on a regular basis. We have a service called Publishing Plus, where authors can apply for the layout and then they get it free of cost by us. And of course, they can also do it themselves and we can provide templates, or they ask a third person to do it for them and then pay for it or organize it themselves. So there are various options for this. And generally speaking, publishing with HASP is free of cost if authors decide to publish in open access only. That is, if they want to have an ebook only. They can, of course, also have a print on demand version of the book. And then we charge a 300 euro one-time fee to cover some of our administrative expenses. And this is possible because HASP is administered by Heidelberg University Library, which is, of course, an academic institution in public ownership. So we are not a company, and we calculate the book prices of our book to cover our expenses, but not to make any profit out of book sales. And I think that is a great advantage for authors as well, because we don't charge open access fees, and we are funded by a third by a project, so we get project funds, and of course we are funded as a public institution by what's it called in German, by der Öffentlichkeit. August, maybe you can help me out here.
Well, the public or the state. Yeah.
Yes, the state.
Yeah. Yeah. Taxes.
Yeah, that's an incredible opportunity for prospective authors. I mean, in terms of, it's a handful, maybe you've come across a handful of presses that have something similar. The Austrian Academy, there's Australian National University, its press. I've come across maybe three. They have hundreds of books in the last 4 or 5 years. And typically, you know, I can only speak for myself on the other end of that. When publishing, I have three books out on each time I had the opportunity to publish open access, but it would have cost me somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 USD. And now, you know, certainly whether or not one is a professor or independent scholar or whatever, that certainly isn't a tiny sum of money, right? Particularly exerting so much labor to produce the book, labor for which you need to pay to make it accessible for others. So it really is, to my mind, hopeful that there are institutions and circumstances that really appreciate the importance, the significance of open access. Without question, open access resources receive so much more attention and so many more people can benefit from them. And this is not just people in the quote-unquote so-called first world or in Europe or in North America. There are people throughout South Asia, people throughout various spaces who, you know, could readily have access to that without cost being a barrier. And so I think it's fantastic.
Yes, I think that's true. And what I find difficult is that we fund research with public money, and then we buy it back as a published institution from publishers. And these open access fees are much too high. And I think we need more enterprises like that. So open access publishing services in the hands of an academic institutions like libraries, for example, because they have the infrastructure. And what I see in our publications is they are downloaded in South Asia from South Asian countries. These countries are among the top three countries from where the downloads come. So I guess our books are well received there. And for scholars in South Asia, it's not possible to buy, or not easily possible to buy, expensive books from commercial publishers. So they might be excluded from the research results.
Yeah, without question, that's the case. I think the Australian National University, there's a recent co-edited volume with McComas Taylor on Sanskrit narrative that we just produced, and they have access to numbers, and the numbers are always quite good. People are interested around the world. Part of the enterprise of the New Books Network is actually rendering accessible at least what the research is about or key findings. So many of the listeners, I mean, it's really fascinating. Typically, you're used to speaking to a public audience, or you're at a conference where you're speaking to specialists, or you're teaching somewhere in between. But interesting in that this podcast audience is everything from the interested layperson to our specialist colleagues who are listening. And so it just shows the power of these media to reach people who are interested in these ideas. And the paywall is problematic for a variety of reasons. You know, like in my particular case, I have a number of teaching affiliations with institutions, but I'm technically independent as a researcher. And so, you know, there are opportunities for me to have alumni access to the University of Toronto system, which is vast and incredible, but the access would be limited. And it also is pricey, et cetera, et cetera. There are a number of scholars in this day and age who simply don't have institutional access. They're either in between or they're independent. And so imagine folks who are publishing books who they themselves can't afford extra copies of their books. So it really is, I think, an important thrust that's afoot. And I imagine, you know, I don't know. I mean, the optimist in me imagines that this might be an example for other institutions to follow in other series. I mean, I just feel like the tide can't be held back. In about 100 years' time, I think open access will be certainly the rule versus the exception. Is there anything else that either of you wanted to say, either about the series, about the press, about all things Indic? Really, it's, the floor is yours.
Well, I would like to encourage everyone listening to this podcast to think about whether they would be interested in publishing with us, either with the series Ethno-Indology, which would be published by HASP anyway, or with directly with the publisher. Have a look at our websites. Look at the different volumes, also the Ethno-Indology past volumes are currently being digitized, so a number of the volumes are already available at the website. You might want to listen to Ina Ilkema's podcast, which was the one preceding ours, so you will have an impression of what this what a volume in this series could look like. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to contact us, either Nicole Merkel or myself or Axel Michaels. We're happy to answer any questions.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you both very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you, Raj, for having us. That's very nice.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. So for those listening, hopefully you will take interest and perhaps even take action in accessing these brilliant works that are part of the Ethno-Indology series, the Heidelberg Studies in South Asian Rituals, and have a look at the HASP website. We've linked all of this in the podcast notes. So have a look. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, and keep contemplating the future of open access publishing. Take care.